Okay, here we go with the recorded lecture. And I'm in my office. That'll undoubtedly mean the phone will ring and people will be knocking on the wall or the door or something, but we're going to give it a shot. We had finished up talking about glomerular inflammatory diseases. And the last thing we talked about in class, there was minimal change and how that was kind of the quintessential example of nephrotic syndrome. The next thing then is a serious problem, and that is diabetes, obviously a frequent thing today, type 2 diabetes anyway. Now, diabetes involves all parts of the kidney, the glomerulus, the large vessels, the small vessels. Because it's a vascular, small vessel and large vessel vascular disease, it means there's chronic ischemia of the connective tissue of the kidney. It means there's increased chance for infection and so on. We're going to take a look at various parts of the kidney that are affected here, the most notable being the glomerulus and the afferent and efferent arterioles both. Again, diabetes is really a small vessel vascular disease because the high blood sugar, well, all the blood sugar, even in us, leads to cross-linking of proteins and spontaneous glycolation, as it's called, advanced glycolated end products. And that goes on in all of us to a certain degree, but our systems can keep up with it and rebuild the proteins and get rid of the stuff. But with the high levels of sugar that we see in diabetics, you just simply can't do it. You end up with a lot of protein you just can't get rid of, and it accumulates and causes a lot of malfunction or thickened blood vessels. So this is an arteriolar disease. And again, I want to emphasize that all parts of the kidney become involved, right from the small blood vessels to the glomerulus, the large vessels, the interstitial tissue and everything. What we're looking at in this picture is very diagnostic. It's called Kimmel-Still-Wilson change, and it is these large globular areas here. We see these globs of protein in the basement membrane. Again, this is being driven by a non-enzymatic glycolation of the proteins. Here would be an example. This could actually be hypertension. It's probably diabetic related, but here's either an afferent or efferent arteriole, and you can see how thickened the wall is, and because the wall is so thickened, the lumen is smaller, and so it gets compressed. And again, the wall is thickened because of accumulation of these glycolated end products, so-called advanced glycolated end products. This is exactly the same thing that's going on in the retina. It's going on every place in the body that leads to gangrenous change of the extremities, like the legs and so forth. It leads to problems with nerve conduction, so-called neuropathy. So there's the vascular component of this, the microscopic vascular disease that's part of diabetes, is really what drives all the long-term complications. And this is it right here. This is the formation of what are called shift bases. I'm sure you've heard it said, shift happens, and this is what they're talking about when they say that. Glucose will spontaneously react. This double-bonded oxygen right here is highly reactive. It's going to want to give up one of those electrons, and what it's going to do, it's going to react with the amino group on proteins, but it will then, it can cause protein cross-linking. And once that you get that shift base formation and you get proteins cross-linked, you can't get rid of them. You end up with crazy organizations of proteins that the degradative enzymes have no idea what to do with. And so you accumulate all this protein and basement membrane material, and you might think, hey, well, wait a minute, you got a really fat basement membrane and nothing ought to get through it. In fact, it's just the opposite. The bigger and thicker it is, the spongier it is, and everything flies right on through there. So you've got a lot of these cross-linked proteins that you can't get rid of because shift happened. That's the advanced glycolated. We talked about age. I have in the notes H proteins, capital AGE. We're talking about advanced glycolated end products, and this is it. And this is what's thickening up the walls of the blood vessels and what you see in the kidney in the case of these big globs of stuff. So you've got reduced blood flow into the kidney. So the kidney is going to try and increase the blood pressure because it doesn't understand why it doesn't have the blood flow, because the vessel walls are so thickened. And by virtue of that, then the lumens are quite narrowed. As I mentioned, diabetes affects everything. It affects tubular function, the interstitium, increased numbers of infections. All aspects, every last part, every aspect of the kidney is detrimentally affected because it's a small vessel vascular disease, really, when we are finished looking at it. We look for microalbuminuria and leakage of proteins. Early on, we get these crappy blood vessels. We get new vascular growth, exactly the way we do in the retina. We see new blood vessels being proliferated, but they're unhealthy blood vessels. They're leaky. They lead to, in the case of the retina, they'll lead to leakage of proteins and exudates. Probably isn't the right term to use. I don't like to use it, but that's what people do. And in the kidney, it leads to leakage of proteins into the urine. We see microalbuminuria. That is just small amounts of that stuff. Your book does a very nice job dealing with this, and I want you to read that part. Now, the last thing in terms of glomerular disease is something that we used to think was very uncommon, but now we realize it's quite common and has a very characteristic presentation. This is called IgA nephropathy. It goes by the term of Berger's disease. And what we see are IgA deposits, and you'll notice from the immunostaining here that this is occurring in the mesangium. You don't see that glomerular pattern. You'll see that basic membrane pattern. This has to do with the IgA that should really be produced and released on the mucosal surfaces like tears, GI tract. In some people, it is produced, and the two IgAs together are released from the bone marrow, which really should not be the case. But in some people, that is the situation, and this stuff tends to accumulate, for whatever reason, in the mesangium. Well, in any event, it will cause injury, and people will have repeat bouts, typically starting in the teens or 20s, and they'll have repeat bouts of a nephritis, of inflammation of the glomerulus. They'll pee blood. They'll be sick. If they had taken a look at the microscopic analysis on the urine, they would have seen red blood cell casts and so forth, and then they get over it for some reason. And they may give a history of maybe three or four previous episodes when they're finally seen. That's a common kind of presenting symptom. I often ask a question about this, something along the lines of a person who's 25 years of age. I may throw in a sore throat as a complete red herring, but it's the repeat bouts of that. They get transplanted frequently, but that kidney, the new kidney, may also accumulate the IgAs. So again, read about Berger's disease. That's the one I like to ask a question about. And we're going to look now at tubular disease. Remember, pretty much everything, all the stuff we talked about here was all glomerular injury. If we take a look at tubular and interstitial disease, these two really go hand in hand. If we damage the tubules, there's often leakage of stuff into the interstitial tissue. If there's infection in the interstitial tissue, so-called pyelonephritis, it typically affects and causes damage to the tubular epithelium. When I say tubular epithelium and tubular cell necrosis, we're talking about the cells that line the proximal and convoluted tubules and the loop of Henle. So these two kind of go hand in hand. We're going to talk first about acute tubular necrosis, so-called acute kidney injury nowadays, but this would be something that would be related to typically bouts of hypotension. It complicates something else. And then we'll take a look at infections. Now, acute tubular necrosis, we used to call acute ATN. Now it's called acute kidney injury. Most frequently occurs because of hypotension. A person who has very low blood pressure, say because they've had a serious hemorrhage, maybe a bleed from an ulcer or bleed from trauma from an auto accident, or maybe they've had a heart attack and they have lost the pumping capacity. Of course, the heart's acutely weakened and it doesn't pump blood well, and so they don't have enough perfusion. Remember that all the blood that supplies the interstitial tissue and the tubules has to first come through the glomerulus. So it's already reduced in blood pressure, and it may be reduced in terms of water content as well. Well, if you drop your blood pressure, it means that the stuff after the glomerulus is going to really have low blood pressure. The stuff coming out in that efferent arteriole, that blood is going to be greatly diminished in terms of pressure. Its ability to deliver oxygen and so forth to the tissues will be greatly reduced just because it can't flow. What will happen is the tubular epithelium will die, it will fall off the basement membrane, it'll be shed into the tubular lumen, and typically it clogs it up. All the dead cells just essentially clog it all up, and all of a sudden there's no urine output at all. Typically some cells survive, and if they they'll eventually repopulate that. Now, another kind of thing can happen would be toxic injury, and here we can see the difference. In the case of ischemic injury, oxygen deprivation, we see bits and pieces of this thing dying. If it's a toxic injury, say like somebody drank antifreeze, and the glycolates in the antifreeze will kill those tubular cells, well, it kills all of them. So toxic injury tends to lead to a much more uniform death, particularly of the proximal convoluted tubule. And the same thing happens. The tubular epithelial cells fall off. They clog up the base, they clog up the lumen, and then there's no urine production at all, no urine output. And we don't have any real good concentration gradient for a while after the thing gets repopulated. So it's a real challenge to get people through that. It always complicates something else. When they've lost that concentration gradient, you can anticipate that when those tubular epithelial cells that are dead and clogging up the lumen, when they finally break down and everything is released, they pee like a Russian racehorse. They got no capacity to concentrate urine until they reestablish that concentration gradient. Now, pyelonephritis is the term that applies to infection, direct infection. Actually, let's say acute inflammation, most of which is going to be infection in the connective tissue of the kidney itself. And so what we're seeing here will be bacteria and a bacterial response in the tissue substance of the kidney. Now, I'll have to say that you can have other things. We can have toxic injury. There are certain things that will bind in there or impair the connective tissue's capability of removing oxidant and dealing with oxidant injury. A heavy dose of acetaminophen, good old Tylenol, will do that. It soaks up all of the glutathione so that you don't have capacity to really deal with oxidative damage. Even non-steroidal anti-inflammatories like aspirin can also affect interstitial function because it retards the kidney's ability, the vessels of the kidney, their ability to dilate and have good flow. We talked about planted antigens in the first hour, and sometimes we will have antigens such as, again, amoxicillin or something like that that get bound or incorporated into the connective tissue of both the glomerulus as well as the interstitial tissue, and that will lead to can lead to immunologic injury. So acute pyelonephritis, acute inflammation, and acute damage to the interstitial tissue, that is the connective tissue of the kidney itself, can occur for a variety of reasons. I would say the most common by far is a direct bacterial infection. Bacteria can get seeded into that because they can come from the urine in the bladder back up the ureters and into the kidney tissue. They can also be seeded in there because we may have bacteria in the bloodstream and they may colonize the kidney. And again, where they're growing then in the connective tissue that holds the whole kidney together, not surrounding the kidney, but the connective tissue of the kidney itself. So ascending, so-called coming from the urine up, is the most common. Those are gram-negative bugs, and they inflect that, and they'll cause the tubular cells to die. And we'll see bacteria in the bloodstream, we may see it in the bloodstream, but we'll see it in the urine. We may see casts composed of dead epithelial cells and so forth. These people are real sick. They have temperature, their white count goes way up, peripheral count goes way up. They'll often pass blood and urine, and they really feel bad. They've got terrible flank pain because the kidney swells and it can't go anywhere. It's in a capsule. When we stretch that capsule, it's really painful. So kidney infections are most often what we see here, where we have urine that's being retrograded back up. And that might occur because the implant angle of the ureter down here at the bladder isn't quite right. And then we'll see that maybe in children. In older people like me, older guys who've got a big prostate, and the urine, when you try to urinate, sometimes it blows the urine back up through those ureters. Sometimes it's, again, brought by bloodstream, and that's just being demonstrated over here when we have bacteremia. And that is bacteria in the bloodstream, and it may populate, and we'll see little abscesses like that But this is the more typical thing over here. So this is a picture showing two different ways. It doesn't mean to imply that this is what's going on. Both of these go on at the same time. And I suppose it could, but it's showing the two different mechanisms. So ureteral reflux, that is urine coming back up the urinary, is an important element in elderly people. Also in people who have spinal cord injuries. People who are paraplegic from, say, a car accident, they don't have good bladder control, and they may not urinate. And the end result is that they may have a lot of urine in the bladder. They have to catheterize themselves often, so they just basically live with kind of low-level infections in the urine. And they're ones who can also get this because they don't have good bladder function, good peristalsis in the ureters. So other things that affect it, diabetics don't have good peristalsis because of the small vessel disease, so they don't have good ureteral function. And also, because of the poor oxygenation of the kidney tissue, if they get any bacteria up there, the bacteria tend to grow to beat the band. Any kind of vascular disease is going to affect this. I mentioned that in some people, they may have a different ureteral implant angle. If we go back to this, what we're going to do is we're going to take a look at where the ureter comes through into the urinary bladder right here. And normally the implant angle is about 45 degrees. So when you urinate and the bladder wall, which is right here, so the bladder lumen is over here by the words, when you urinate and it compresses the bladder, it actually sort of squeezes off the ureter so urine will not retrograde and go back up there. If, on the other hand, you have a bladder angle of something like this, when you urinate, urine can very easily go back up. And we see this in kids occasionally, children who have an abnormal implant angle. Interestingly enough, that will frequently straighten itself out as they grow. And so typically, we just treat that with antibiotics, but you can surgically go in and replant that. So sometimes you do have to do a surgical correction of that. Now, we use the term chronic pyelonephritis. We've been talking about acute changes because it was acute bacterial or acute injury from, let's say, immune complexes or cross-reacting antibodies or something. We can also have chronic injury. And chronic pyelonephritis is something in which it goes on for a long time, but in addition to that, the inflammatory infiltrate, chronic cells. When we talk about chronic inflammation, there are three hallmarks, whether we see it in the kidney, in the liver, in the lungs, anywhere we see it, there are three hallmarks about chronic inflammation. Number one, there's a characteristic inflammatory cell, and that is to say the round cell. That is lymphocytes and plasma cells and macrophages. There's ongoing tissue destruction because it goes on for a long period of time. And because of that, and because of the prolonged stimulus of the immune mediators, there's typically extensive fibrosis. Well, chronic pyelonephritis is something we see often associated with diabetes because it's definitely related to a chronic ischemia of the tissues. We'll see it with hypertension for the same reason, because of the vascular changes over time. We can see it with repeat infections. And one of the hallmark features microscopically will be the thyroidization. Let me just take a look here first. This is an old gnarled up kidney. You can see all the scar tissue that's in it. Grossly, you can see all these retracted scars, very little functioning tissue left. Periglomerular fibrosis, scarring around here, chronic inflammatory cells. And we'll also see dilated tubules. And the dilated tubules often contain old urine that's been kind of dehydrated, and it's kind of pink staining urine in there. So it creates the illusion that it's like thyroid tissue. They look like thyroid follicles. Lots of chronic inflammation, and these dilated tubules, because of all the scar tissue, they simply no longer communicate well with the rest of the urinary collection system. We refer to that as thyroidization. It's really not thyroid tissue. It just kind of mimics it or looks like that. So that would be chronic pyelonephritis. Very common, as you can imagine, by the time you get to be in 70s and 80s, probably a lot of people have had some degree of kidney infection. They all have old hard vessels that don't work well. If they're diabetic, it's a disaster. So this kind of goes hand in hand with vascular insufficiency, arteriolar disease, hypertension, and diabetes, and so forth. Another thing that can happen with advanced changes like that is that part of the kidney will actually die. The renal papillae, the little parts of the medulla, will die and actually fall off, dislodge from the kidney proper and fall into the collecting system. And then they will be obstructed. They will become an obstruction within the ureter. So this right here is a very end-stage looking kind of a kidney here. These are all old scarred up glomeruli, lots of inflammation in here. And here we can see a contrast study showing a ureter that's dilated, and all of a sudden there's an obstruction here. Now what that turned out to be was this little chunk of dead tissue about the size of a raisin. This looks like a little raisin. And that was a piece of dead tissue from the kidney itself that died and fell off of there because of chronic vascular insufficiency. We see that in diabetes. We also see it in people who take a lot of non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, say for arthritis or even lots of Tylenol. And, of course, it's related to chronic pyelonephritis. So that's renal papillary necrosis. Now, hypertension is really a disaster in the kidneys. The high blood pressure kidney really can't protect itself from it other than for the blood vessels becoming very hyperplastic. The small vessels, the arterioles, they will thicken up. And if the walls get thicker as a compensatory move against high blood pressure, basically the wall gets thicker, which means the lumen gets smaller. And this is arterioles I'm talking about, not arteries, not the bigger arteries, but the tiny arterioles like the afferent and efferent arterioles. And as those things thicken up as a reaction, or at least the afferent arteriole will, as a reaction to the high blood pressure, you decrease the amount of blood that's coming through the kidney. So these are just some of the problems of hypertension right here. You can see myocardial infarction, you can see strokes, but a long-term thing is going to be kidney injury. So high blood pressure, untreated high blood pressure, plays hell on these kidneys. These are some of the changes that we would see, showing this old gnarled up and scarred kidney because of the small vessel vascular disease. The hallmark would be this onion skinning of these small blood vessels. And what we look at here is this increased proliferation of smooth muscle cells, and it's a response to the high blood pressure. We can also have something like that in the larger arteries, which we see here. But ultimately what's occurring is as the walls get thicker, as a reactive process, we see the lumen getting smaller. And a small lumen means less blood flow, and that's really the whole thing. Well, what will happen, of course, is the kidney will start to drive this process now. If you have thickened blood vessels and diminished blood flow, the kidney may release more renin than angiotensin, and it may actually start the process, aggravate the process that got it into the problem in the first place. So we can see the arteriolar changes very frequently with hypertensive old long-standing hypertension. We'll see chronic pyelonephritis with lots of scarring and even chronic inflammation, and in time, complete renal failure. Other vascular problems that we're going to see here, well, obviously, we've kind of beat diabetes to death here. We can have clotting problems and embolization. And I kind of alluded to sickle cell disease in the very first few minutes of the first lecture. But in case of sickle cell disease, you got to keep in mind that even in the healthy, all healthy people, not whether you got sickle cell disease or not, that efferent blood flow is kind of slow and the blood's a little dehydrated. And so it's a little bit thicker. Now, if you've got sickle cell disease, you can imagine that you're going to have sickling cells that may occur in the efferent blood, in that efferent arteriole and downstream. And so people with homozygous sickling gene are going to be at real risk for kind of advanced kidney damage. All right. Polycystic kidney disease. This is something that's inherited. There are several varieties of this. And these are really problems with epithelial cell growth, and they form cysts. And as the cysts accumulate fluid, and you have got a blue million of these cysts in each kidney, basically the fluid, as it accumulates, it begins to increase the size of the cyst, and it compresses the tissue around it. Well, if you got only one or two cysts, it's not going to make a big difference. But if you got a million of these things, basically it compresses all of the tissue, causes vascular insufficiency, and the kidney tissue dies. So polycystic kidney disease, which frankly occurs pretty frequently, is a growth of tubular epithelium leading to cyst formation. And as that fluid accumulates then within the cyst, it cannot get out. It basically squeezes the tissue around it, which causes the kidney to die. We divide it into adult and juvenile forms. Now, even the adult forms are inherited. I mean, it was present at the time of birth, but the difference is that we recognize it as adult because that's how long it takes for the cyst fluid and the cyst to grow before they kill off the kidney. Typically, it means around the age of 30 or so, these people are beginning to show signs of renal failure. Some people survive all the way into the 50s or 60s because it's a slower process, but it doesn't come up when prepubertal. There are others in which we have very rapidly forming cysts, and that is a juvenile form, and that just means, and again, these are both they're both autosomal inherited genes. One is a dominant, one's recessive, but they are. And the way in which the kidney fails is exactly the same. It gets squeezed, or, you know, the kidney tissue gets compressed to death. But we divide it up based on when do they present with the failure, kidney failure. And once you know it's in the family, we're sort of following that along. We're going to check all the other people. We're going to do ultrasounds or look for the genetics of it on their kidneys and be prepared. Eventually, they're going to get a transplant. This right here would be a typical polycystic kidney disease. We have those that occur, I note in the notes here, either medullary cystic or cortical cysts. The medullary cystic disease is kind of uncommon. This is much more common, about 1 in 1,000 people. And which means that we've got, out of 35,000 people running around here on campus, you know, we've got 35, 40 people with adult polycystic kidney disease on campus. That's an important one to keep in mind. And again, when they present with kidney failure, they're going to present with everything that's going. Remember their uremic syndrome, same for the diabetic, same for the chronic pyelonephritic, all those kinds of things. They're going to present with a total kidney failure, which includes anemia because there's no erythropoietin. It includes the business of problems with acid-base metabolism, calcium metabolism, and variety of things. All right, let's take a look here at kidney tumors. Kidney tumors can be benign or malignant. All of these tumors arise from the tubular epithelium, either proximal or distal convoluted tubule, most from the proximal. We don't see tumors arising from the vascular structures very often. It's very unusual. The most common kind of tumor, it comes from the proximal convoluted tubule. And benign tumors are pretty common. They're typically small. They don't grow very fast at all. If it's just an isolated tumor, we may never know we have it, and it's a complete incidental finding if we do an autopsy on a person. Generally speaking, they're under 2 centimeters in size. We call them cortical adenomas, and again, they come from proximal convoluted tubular cells. They don't metastasize. There's no real anaplasia. On microscopic section, they're what we call clear cells, and I'll show you an example of that. They are, in life, they actually contain a lot of lipid, and they're kind of golden yellow. What we're looking at here with this slide is actually a cancer, but the benign tumors can look about the same, only they're just very small and they don't go anywhere. So we see them as golden yellow, but when we process the tissue to make a slide and we put it through the fixative and then through xylene and so forth, it washes out all the lipids. And when we see the microscopic section, it looked like there's nothing in the cell. Well, there was at one time, but not any longer. The malignant form of this thing can be very elusive. We know a good bit about the genetics of it now. It likes to invade vascular structures. It metastasizes very widely. It's not a real common tumor, but once it's there, it's very unpredictable, and it's very hard to treat. And here we're taking a look at one. You can see it's quite large, certainly bigger than 2 centimeters. We can see a very profound distortion of the, we're looking here at a kidney. We can see a distortion of we're looking at an injection study of the blood vessels, by the way. These are highly vascularized. They produce, they're part of the genetics of them, comes up in a gene that's involved with vascular growth. And so they love blood vessels. You can see cystic areas, they grow so quickly, parts of them die. And we'll see cystic areas like that. So that's the malignant form. This is a renal cell, clear cell carcinoma. In this case, it does metastasize. It's quite malignant. On rare occasions, they may produce erythropoietin. Blood pressure issues may be a problem because it might produce renin. They come from tubular cells that could do that. The vascular, the surgical margin, interestingly enough, is the blood vessel itself. Now, unless this really stretches the capsule of the kidney abruptly, it often is painless. It doesn't cause a lot of discomfort. So one of the reasons that this thing is probably such a nasty tumor is by the time we come to diagnose it, it's been there probably for several years, and it's already spread. About the only symptom is painless hematuria. In other words, people don't complain of pain, but they may pee out some blood periodically, and that may be the giveaway. It's a tumor of older people. So there you have it. Now, there is a rather uncommon malignancy that arises in the kidney in newborns or in very young children, and this probably represents an embryonic rest. It's a tumor. When I say an embryonic rest, what I'm talking about is the embryonic tissue of the kidney, some part of it never fully matured. And so it remained as kind of embryonic in nature, but it may become malignant, and then it grows as a malignancy. So it's a childhood tumor. We don't see this in adults at all. Typically, it's in the first couple of years of life. Very embryonic appearing tissue. It looks like embryonic kidney. We see two cell types, kind of a stroma, and what looks like little abortive tubes or maybe even glomeruli. Mother is often the one that diagnoses this. She'll be changing the baby's diaper and she'll notice that the abdomen is asymmetric. Well baby checks always involve palpating the abdomen for tumors like this. If it's recognized early, treatment, surgical removal, radiation treatments, and chemotherapy are very helpful. If it's metastatic, it doesn't do so well. It's called a Wilms tumor. It's a childhood tumor, pretty unusual. But there it is. Occasionally, we're going to be talking now about the urinary bladder. On occasion, we will see tumors arising in the ureters and in the pelvis of the kidney, arising from the transitional epithelium that lines the duct's work. And that's different than ductal cell carcinoma, or ones that rise from the proximal convoluted tubule. So we'll take a look at that. Okay, lower urinary tract, meaning the ureters and bladder. Infections are really the big ticket item. Many people develop occasionally in life bladder infections. Occasionally they have stones either up in the kidney or even in the bladder. And there's bladder cancer that can form. And we'll talk about each of those. Bladder infections, again, are very common. Most of the bacteria are ones that we have in the stool. They infect the urine, and our bladder urine is actually not totally sterile. So the most common organism will be things like E. coli and Klebsiella, mostly gram-negative organisms we'd have in the stool that might contaminate and come through the urethra. The urethra is the tube that goes either down the penis or just out in a woman in the perineum, so you can urinate. Catheterization, sometimes we refer to this as instrumentation of the bladder, passing a catheter up in the bladder, introduces bacteria there. Occasionally that's done for diagnostic purposes. In other words, a doctor might want to get bladder urine, so they'll catheterize a person. But the people who have to live with that day in and day out are people who are paraplegic, either because of tumor compression of the spinal cord or injury fractures, because of auto accidents or, you know, accidents at work or whatever, and they have to catheterize themselves a lot. I mean, every day, multiple times. And so they just live with the issue of non-sterile urine, and sometimes, of course, that can lead to upwards to kidney infections as well. If anybody's had a bladder infection, they know about it. You have a lot of urgency. You've got to go pee. When you pee, it hurts. When you're through peeing, you feel like you're not through peeing and that sort of thing. Occasionally, we'll see blood in the urine that's coming from the urinary bladder because of infection. Kidney stones are not unusual. There are people who are chronic stone formers who either pass a lot of certain amino acids in the urine or have problems with maintaining urine pH, urine acidity. And the stones form typically, these are calcium oxalate stones. It's important that the doctor have the stone analyzed so they can determine what the composition is, because there are some stones that are related to infection within the kidney that the person may not even know they've got. And in that case, it's important to be on the right antibiotic to take care of that. Most of the stones, however, are not related to kidney infection or colonization of the pelvis of the kidney. Most of them, frankly, are just related to dehydration. If you're really dehydrated, you know, if you've got the squirts and you've been barfing all night and been squirting away and you get really dehydrated, your urine is extremely concentrated. And there are materials in there, calcium oxalate again, that will crystallize. And that's probably the most common thing. People on high-protein diets have an increased incidence of this. And again, genetics, people who pass a lot of particular kinds of amino acids can have stones. Once you've had one, you don't want another one. The stone itself, when it's up in the kidney, is not symptomatic. But when it dislodges, when it comes out of the kidney and either gets stuck, as we see it right here, or maybe further down into the down in the kidney, when it comes down through the wall of the bladder, when that ureter, all the urine backs up in the ureter, it is extremely painful. People describe this pain, if they've had one, there's nothing like it, and they will never want another one. Again, most of these are not related to genetic syndromes. Most of them is just related to dehydration. So kidney stones, not an uncommon thing. Here's a big old stone right here, kidney calculus right here in this kidney. This kidney is really kind of blown up and deformed here. This is probably an old, it's probably been there for a long time. They had some infections and problems with, obviously, the urine outflow. So the kidney kind of, the pelvis of the kidney sort of blew up, became what's called hydronephrotic, meaning water within it. Just means it has a very enlarged a very enlarged pelvis. And that means compression and compressional atrophy of the kidney parenchyma itself. So that kidney wasn't doing anything. That's why it got removed. Well, it might have been causing high blood pressure. Who knows? Now, tumors of the lower urinary tract are transitional epithelium. We're looking at a urinary bladder here with what looks like a big old shrubbery growth on it. The mucosa is over here, so this has been cut open so we can look into this thing. Almost all of the malignancies of the urinary bladder are frankly related to tobacco smoke. A lot of toxins and carcinogens are in that tobacco smoke. They get cleared in the urine. It's then concentrated, and then it stays in the urinary bladder. And so you have all of these broken down products and carcinogens being concentrated and staying in there while you're wondering, is the lecturer ever going to shut up so I can go out and take a leak? Definitely industrial exposure. People who work in the plastics industry and the anil and dye industry and so forth have an increased incidence of this. Once again, they're taking in agents that serve as carcinogens, and then it gets cleared in the urine, and there it stays affecting the bladder mucosa. The cells that line the bladder and also line the ureter and the pelvis of the kidney are called transitional cells or transitional epithelium. And you can have cancer arising in that epithelium anywhere from the kidney down into the bladder, but most times it's in the bladder because the bladder is the holding tank. And so it has the urine in it, and if you have carcinogens in there, they're going to have prolonged exposure to that. You don't have urine standing in the ureters or in the pelvis of the kidney. So we want to take a good look at if we get a bladder, almost always papillary growths like this. See, it looks like a little shrubbery with extensions of branches and so forth. It's kind of a central fibrovascular stalk. And the bladder, the malignant cells, kind of call into being that connective tissue, that vascularized connective tissue that they use as a stroma to grow on. And then they can spread. Of course, it is cancer, so it'll spread into the regional lymph nodes. It'll invade tissues locally and so forth. And it's a real bear once it spreads. So this is different than renal cell carcinoma. we talked about renal cell carcinoma, and that was cancers arising from the proximal convoluted tubular epithelium, at least most of them do. This is coming from the lining epithelium of the urinary system, the transitional epithelium that lines the ureters and the urinary bladder. And this is what one of those little capillary fronds would look like if we were to come up here and cut off one of these little branches, take a look at it microscopically. We'd see this benign fibrovascular stalk surfaced with malignant epithelial cells. And all these right here are the cancer cells. And the cancer cells are elaborating a substance that are inducing fibroblastic and vascular growth so that they have some kind of stroma to grow on. The fibroblasts and the angioblasts, this stuff is benign, but the malignant cells are on the surface. And we look for something like greater than 7 layers of epithelium, but we can tell when you take a look at it, you know, from the cytology of the cells, what they look like. And the urethra, which is the coming out of the penis or something, that can obviously get inflamed. I don't have it in the notes here. We're about to finish this up, obviously. But the urethra can get infected. Of course, a major thing here would be gonorrhea and HPV, that sort of business. And that has already been dealt with or will be dealt with.